Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo brings us words and their stories. Later, Faith Lapidus, Jack Moyles, and Stan Busby present Making of a Nation. But first, this report. Student loan debt is a worldwide problem. In the United States, the country's overall student debt reached a record $1.6 trillion this year. The average person with student loan debt in the U.S. owes between $20,000 and nearly $25,000. In Japan, the group that oversees the government's student loan system recently reported it has been lending over $9 billion to students every year since 2010. Similar conditions exist in Africa and South America, says former United Nations Population Division Director Joseph Chami. He suggests several reasons for high student loan debt. One is that employers everywhere have increased their demands for skilled workers, making higher education a requirement for many jobs. This means more students are seeking higher education worldwide than ever before. At the same time, governments are investing less money in public colleges and universities. They are refusing to raise taxes and use existing tax money to meet other needs, Chami says. So, more students are attending private institutions, which are often more costly. However, students often find that once they complete their education, their country's economy is not strong enough to support their financial needs. For example, about 28% of four-year degree holders in Malaysia had no job in 2015. A lot of them, when they're finishing, are either unemployed or underemployed, so their ability to pay back the loan becomes a problem, Chami told VOA.
Even in countries like Sweden, where attending university is free, about 70% of students still borrow an average of about $20,000 total. That is because students still face other living costs, like food and housing. As student debt has become a global problem, countries are seeking ways to solve it. Australia, for example, has established a system where students do not have to pay anything back until they are earning at least $40,000 a year. In the U.S., several candidates running for president in the 2020 election have offered more extreme solutions. Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren suggest it is in the nation's best interest to forgive all or at least some of these loans. Some researchers recently asked what the effects of debt forgiveness might be. Ankit Kalda is an assistant professor of finance at Indiana University. In September, he and researchers from Harvard University and Georgia State University published a study on debt relief. Their study came out of an unusual situation. In 2017, U.S. courts found that a large financial organization had made mistakes in its record keeping. The company could not show that it owned the debt of 2,000 borrowers. Therefore, they had to remove it. And so suddenly, a number of people were told they did not need to pay back the money they had borrowed.
Calda and his team looked at what happened to some of these people. The researchers found that, overall, sudden debt relief greatly improved the borrowers' lives. For example, not only did they have more money, they were more likely to move to a new area and seek better-paying work. In time, they began earning more money, on average about $3,000 more a year. In addition, they no longer had negative information about late or missed debt payments on their credit report. A negative credit history can harm a person's ability to find a well-paying job in the United States. Charlotte Hancock argues these findings are evidence enough that some kind of debt relief plan must move forward. Hancock is the communications director for Generation Progress, the youth-centered research and activism part of the Center for American Progress. Young people are just entering the time in their lives when they can be financially independent, start families, and really add to the economy, she says. But their ability to do so is greatly limited if they have debt hanging over them. Even beyond some of the financial stresses here, the mental burden, just being thousands of dollars in student debt that you feel you'll never be able to repay, is huge, said Hancock.
Generation Progress suggests several ways debt relief could happen. They suggest policymakers could require lenders to change their agreements to lower interest rates, for example. They also suggest either total or partial debt forgiveness. Yet, Ankit Kalda and his team do not actually support debt forgiveness. Their research does not include a look at what might happen to financial institutions or the overall economy if debt were totally forgiven. It only looks at how debt forgiveness would help the borrowers. Kalda also warns of some other possible negative effects. If, as a borrower, I know that if I run into any trouble, I would be saved because I'm going to get this debt relief, then I might actually become more inclined to be more reckless with my borrowing in the future, he said. No matter what, he and Hancock agree that if countries do decide to approve some student debt relief, the neediest students should be helped first. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Today, we talk about two activities that many people find really fun, and one that makes them happy: singing and dancing. So why is the expression, same old song and dance, not at all related to fun or happiness? That is the question we will answer today. The same old song and dance may sound like a great performance, something that you want to see over and over again, but it is not. Here, the song and dance is a repeated, tired, even predictable reaction to something. It is something we do or say over and over again for different reasons. One online reference guide claims that Americans first began using this expression in the late 1800s. Around that time, vaudeville was a popular form of show business in the United States. In a vaudeville show, performers sang, danced, and acted in short, funny skits. Some shows even had animal acts. Often, a vaudeville show would open with a song and dance. But it often was the same song and dance night after night. And that is where we get the expression, same old song and dance. Americans use this term in different situations, and in each one, there is a slight change in meaning. Here are some ways we use this expression. Sometimes, the same old song and dance can be an overused, weak excuse. It is something we say to others to explain bad behavior. But people have heard it so often that they do not believe it, nor do they care. Listen for this expression in the following example, involving two people in a workplace environment.
Hey, Matt, where are you going in such a hurry?
Hi, Janet. I have to drop off forms to a client before the close of business today.
Why are you taking them yourself? I thought you asked James to take care of things like that.
I did, but he had to take his dog to the animal hospital.
Didn't he give you the same song and dance last week?
No, last week he missed work because he had a doctor's appointment. Again.
He has a different excuse every week.
Now, sometimes the same old song and dance is used to mean someone is trying to trick you. Or at least they are only telling you part of the whole story. For example, at every meeting, a business owner gives her employees the same old song and dance about the company's great plans for the future. But then, nothing happens. Sometimes, the same old song and dance does not mean an excuse or a trick. Sometimes it is just a very long and complex story. Used this way, the speaker wants to justify something. They want to convince the listener that their idea is a good one. But in this case, the listener does not really want or need to hear it. Listen now to how the term song and dance is used to mean a very long, complex explanation.
How was the theater last night?
It was wonderful, and the performance was great, but it just took way too long for the show to start.
Why is that?
Well, before the show, the theater owner made a very long speech about the importance of theater. He's raising money for a theater program for at-risk youth.
Well, that's not a bad thing, right?
Not at all. It's a great program. But we didn't need to hear this whole song and dance. Most of us had already given money. In fact, he ended his hour-long song and dance by thanking everyone for our generous donations.
An hour? That's a really long song and dance.
At other times, the same old song and dance can mean a complex system which involves many steps, like a ritual or ceremony. For example, let's say your friend works for a terrible boss. Every time your friend wants to start a new project, he is required to explain the same steps over and over again. Let's hear how he uses this expression.
Want to go out for a bite to eat?
Sorry, I don't have time today. I have to prepare my project proposal.
What does that involve?
I have to write a report listing my goals. I have to prepare a cost analysis presentation on why it is a worthwhile project. Then I have to prove that no one else in the company is doing it. Then I have to get statements from coworkers who think it's a good idea.
Oh, no. That sounds awful.
And every time I present an idea to the boss, it's the same old song and dance. I'm sick of it.
And that's all the time we have for Words and Their Stories. Have fun using the expression, the same old song and dance, or simply, song and dance. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. As we said last week, James Buchanan of Pennsylvania won the presidential election of 1856. He defeated John Fremont, the candidate of the newly created Republican Party, which opposed slavery. Buchanan, a Democrat, had often supported the South in the dispute over slavery. Most of the new president's closest friends were Southerners. He wrote that the North was too aggressive toward the South and should stop interfering in the slave states. Buchanan said the South had good reason to leave the Union if abolitionists continued their attacks against slavery. Jack Moyles and Stan Busby tell more about James Buchanan, and they discuss his influence in the Supreme Court ruling in the case of a slave from Missouri named Dred Scott.
As the new president, Buchanan believed he could solve the slave question by keeping the abolitionists quiet. Success would mean the end of the anti-slavery Republican Party. In choosing his cabinet, Buchanan wanted men who shared the same ideas and interests. President Pierce had tried to unite the different groups in the party by giving each a representative in his cabinet. This had not worked. It had driven the different party groups farther apart. Buchanan had served in President Polk's cabinet. He remembered how well its members worked together. He said it was the unity of this cabinet that made Polk's administration so successful.
Buchanan gave the job of Secretary of State to Lewis Cass of Michigan. Cass was 75 years old. His mind had lost its sharpness. This did not worry Buchanan, because he had planned to be his own foreign minister. The job of Treasury Secretary went to Howell Cobb, a Southern moderate from Georgia. Southerners also were named as Secretary of War, Interior Secretary, and Postmaster General. Isaac Tousey of Connecticut was given the job of Navy Secretary. Tousey was a Northerner, but he supported many policies of the South. Another Northerner, Jeremiah Black of Pennsylvania, became Attorney General. In forming his cabinet, Buchanan did not ask for advice from Senator Douglas of Illinois. Douglas was the party's leader in the Senate and the most powerful Democrat in the Northwest. Douglas believed that the Northwest should have two representatives in the cabinet. He said Cass could be one of them. But Douglas wanted one of his own supporters to be the other. Buchanan refused what Douglas wanted, and he gave the administration's support to a political enemy of Douglas.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president on March 4, 1857. In his inaugural speech, the new president denounced the long dispute over slavery. He said he hoped it would end soon. Buchanan said the dispute could be settled easily by doing two things. by ending interference with slavery in states where it was legal, and by letting the people of a territory decide if they wanted slavery. Buchanan said he expected the Supreme Court to rule soon on the right of the people of a territory to decide this. He said he was sure that all good citizens, North and South, would accept the High Court's ruling.
At the time he said this, Buchanan already knew what the court's decision would be. He had even used his influence to help one member of the court to decide. The decision was made in the case of Dred Scott, a Negro slave. Scott was sold in Missouri to an army doctor who took him to Illinois and then went into the Wisconsin Territory. Scott lived in these two places for almost 4 years before he was returned to Missouri. Scott asked a court in Missouri to give him his freedom. He claimed that living in Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was illegal, had made him a free man.
The court agreed with Scott and gave him his freedom. But the decision was appealed, and the Supreme Court of Missouri ruled against him. Scott then took his case to a federal court. Finally, he asked the United States Supreme Court to decide if he was a slave or a free man. The Supreme Court took up the case in December 1856. The judges studied it carefully because it raised serious constitutional questions. Scott claimed he was free because he had lived in free territory. It was free because Congress, in the Missouri Compromise of 1820, made slavery illegal in that area. Scott's owner raised the question, did Congress have the constitutional power to close a territory to slavery? Was the Missouri Compromise legal?
At first, most of the nine Supreme Court judges had planned to give a decision without answering this question. They did not want to involve the court in this bitter dispute. The majority decided that a Negro was not a citizen. Therefore, they said, Dred Scott had no right to ask the court to hear his case. In this way, the case could be settled without deciding on the power of Congress to act on slavery in the territories. But two of the nine Supreme Court judges opposed this ruling. Both were from the North. They had said they would write a minority decision. They said their decision would include a statement that Congress did have power over slavery in the territories.
Since two members of the court had planned to offer views on this question, the other seven decided the majority also should do so. Of the seven, five were from the South. They did not believe Congress had any power over territorial slavery. The remaining two judges, both from the North, did not want to make what they felt would be a political decision. One Southern member of the Supreme Court was James Catron, a good friend of James Buchanan. Buchanan had written to him asking when the court would act on the Dred Scott case.
Catron had answered that the court would rule soon. Then he asked for Buchanan's help in getting one of the northern members of the court to vote with the five from the South. He told the president that the country would more easily accept the court's ruling if one of the northern judges gave his support. Catron proposed that Buchanan write to Justice Robert Greer of Pennsylvania. So, Buchanan wrote to Greer. He told him that a strong decision in the Dred Scott case might do much to bring peace to the country. Greer agreed. He said he would vote with the five Southerners. They would rule that the Constitution did not give Congress power over slavery in the territories. All this had happened in the few weeks before Buchanan became president.
The Supreme Court finally announced its decision just 2 days after Buchanan moved into the White House. Chief Justice Roger Taney read the decision in the small courtroom in the Capitol building. The room was crowded with congressmen, senators, government officials, and newspapermen. Chief Justice Taney began reading the decision at 11 o'clock. He read for more than 2.5 hours. He said the High Court rejected Scott's claim of freedom for 3 reasons. First, Scott was not a citizen. Taney said the Constitution gave the right of citizenship only to members of the white race. Because he was not a citizen, he had no right to ask the court to hear his case. Secondly, Taney said Scott was ruled by the laws of Missouri, the state in which he lived. Missouri laws did not give freedom to slaves who lived temporarily in free territory. Therefore, said Taney, Scott was still a slave.
Then the Chief Justice took up the question of the free territory in which Scott had lived. It had become free territory under the Missouri Compromise. This was the law that Congress passed in 1820. This law kept slavery out of the northern part of the territory, which the United States bought from France. Justice Taney said Congress did not have the constitutional power to pass such a law. He said when new territory was won, it belonged to all citizens. He said Congress had the right to govern such territory until it became a state. But, he said, Congress did not have power to close new territory to any American citizen. He said the citizen from Georgia had as much right to settle in this territory with his slaves as a citizen of Maine with his horse. Taney said there was no word in the Constitution that gave Congress greater power over slave property than over any other kind of property. The only such power Congress held was the power to guard and protect the rights of the property owner. To close territory to slaves, Taney said, violated the constitutional rights of slaveholding citizens. Therefore, the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. Congress did not have power to act on slavery in the territories.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.